today, the extraordinary story of former Nissan boss Carlos Ghosn, who fled criminal charges in Japan by allegedly being smuggled out of the country in a musical instrument case. And Gary Young, bowing out as a Guardian columnist and staff writer after 26 years. Stories in the business pages don't often catch the eye of Hollywood scriptwriters, but the case of Carlos Ghosn is an exception.
You're watching France 24. I'm Jeannie Godula. Welcome. This hour, we are focusing on the dramatic escape from Japan of one of the most famous auto executives in the world, Carlos Ghosn.
The former boss of the car giant Nissan had been facing corruption charges in Japan. But then over Christmas, he managed to flee the country by reportedly being smuggled out in a musical instrument case.
This was not about justice. I felt I was a hostage of a country that I have served for 17 years.
Last week, he broke cover at an extraordinary press conference in Beirut, where he called out former colleagues and the entire Japanese justice system.
I am innocent of all the charges, all of them.
If he thinks he's innocent, he should be in a Japanese trial.
But nothing about Carlos Ghosn has ever been ordinary.
I mean, it seems like he was always destined to do something in the car industry. There are reports that as a young boy, he was able to distinguish different types of cars from the sound of their horns.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, why did the former Nissan boss Carlos Ghosn choose a life on the run? Justin, Carlos Ghosn is a colourful figure. What do we know about his background?
Even before the events of the past week, he was, I would argue, the most famous businessman in Japan. I mean, a true celebrity CEO, if you like. He looked different. He got those very pronounced eyebrows. He was instantly recognisable.
Justin McCurry is The Guardian's Tokyo correspondent.
And throughout his 17-year career in Japan as head of Nissan, there's been plenty written about him. There have been manga comics. There have been about 20 books written about his business methods.
By the way, if I have to write a book about being CEO in Europe, I would say life is impossible.
Thank you so much.
He is, I suppose, in every sense, a genuinely international businessman. He was born in Brazil. He grew up in Lebanon. And he, of course, also has French citizenship.
And it was a French car company that he really made his name.
He was hired by Renault to try and turn the company round. This was in the 90s, and he succeeded in doing that. I think he established a reputation at that time for being fairly ruthless. I mean, he cut jobs, he cut costs, and that earned him the nickname Le Cost Killer. You have to excuse my poor schoolboy French accent.
3 years later in 1999, while keeping his role at Renault, Ghosn was also hired to head Nissan and form a new alliance between the two car giants. For some at the Japanese firm, it must have felt threatening. But then I read this incredible detail that Nissan had made a loss of over $6 billion the year before he started, and the next year made a net profit of $2.7 billion. How did he achieve that?
He brought that reputation as a low-cost killer with him. He cut a lot of jobs. He closed Japanese car plants belonging to Nissan. His reasoning was that unless he acted ruthlessly, Nissan would be beyond saving. But he also took another step, and I think that this is what really has contributed to Nissan's success over the last two decades. He looked at Nissan's range of cars, and he wasn't impressed. And that bore fruit eventually with the release of new designs, new models.
Come on, get in!
Rise to any challenge with the 100% electric Nissan Leaf.
Which proved popular with the Japanese and of course in Nissan's many overseas markets, the US and of course Britain. He looked at senior Nissan employees who had perhaps started to rest on their laurels.
I'm here to communicate to you the Nissan revival plan. We will implement the following plant closures. Murayama plant.
And he got rid of the idea of the job for life, which at the time was pretty radical in Japan.
Well, he did, yes, and Nissan certainly wasn't alone in doing that, but Ghosn went further than that and cut jobs.
And his success made him extremely rich. What was his lifestyle like?
So I don't think there's any doubt that as the head of one of Japan's biggest automakers and as the successful CEO and then chairman of one of Japan's biggest companies, that he was well remunerated and he enjoyed a very comfortable lifestyle.
About my salary, what's the question? I mean, every single time I go to the shareholder, I start by answering the question about my compensation.
We know that he traveled a lot and that he celebrated his wife's 50th birthday at the Palace of Versailles and reportedly at huge expense.
You talk about Versailles, any foreigner will come to Versailles. They're amazed by the beauty, by the attraction, by the gardens. That's why we saw Versailles.
But as a public figure, I don't think he ever attempted to portray himself as somebody who enjoyed the high life. He was certainly very personable. I attended briefings by him when he was CEO of Nissan. He apparently got on well with the employees, at least those he didn't let go as part of his cost-cutting regime. So the image that I think he tried to portray to the Japanese public, and one that was sort of in keeping with successful Japanese businessmen in general, was that, yes, he was very well paid, but that he wasn't paid too much.
I feel that to understand this story, there's one other thing that we really need to understand, and that is what Nissan means to Japan.
Nissan's an integral part of Japan's post-war economic miracle. At one point, it was the laughing stock of the world. When people saw that something was made in Japan, they expected that product to be cheap and shoddy. And it was companies like Nissan that helped revolutionize the way Japan went about manufacturing, not just with automobiles, but also, of course, consumer electronics. So Nissan is at the heart of the post-war Japanese economy. And that is why this story in particular, aside from all of the film script type plot twists that we've seen in recent months, has captivated the Japanese public and the international audience quite so strongly.
Clearly, what Carlos Ghosn achieved was incredibly impressive. His star continued to rise. Ford at one point reportedly offered him a job to lead their company. He became the chair of the Russian car manufacturer Autovaz. And in 2016, the Renault-Nissan alliance also got a stake in Mitsubishi. So what went wrong after that?
What worried Japanese executives on the board of Nissan, along with Ghosn, was that he had plans for Renault and Nissan that weren't necessarily going to be to Nissan's long-term benefit and might, in fact, see it swallowed up by its French partner.
And this is where the problem started.
Ghosn himself was beginning to take, I suppose you could call it a step back. He left his post as CEO, became chairman of Nissan, entrusted the day-to-day running of Nissan to Hiroto Saikawa, who was to become a key figure in the case against Carlos Ghosn.
I left with him $20 billion in cash, a company which was profitable, which was growing, which was respected.
And as he said at his press conference on Wednesday,
a brand which was nowhere in 1999, which became one of the top 60 brands in the world. That's what I left with him.
There was an erosion of trust between him and Saikawa.
Who was part of the plot? Obviously, Saikawa is part of the plot.
And other Japanese members of the Nissan board. And this all centered on what they believed would be his ruinous plans for Nissan in terms of its future partnership with Renault.
Some of our Japanese friends thought the only way to get rid of the influence of Renault on Nissan is to get rid of me.
And there clearly isn't any love lost between Ghosn and his successor.
Saikawa was, if Carlos Ghosn is to be believed, plotting to get rid of his colleague, and Ghosn had no inkling. The friction was turning very quickly into something resembling hatred and animosity, and that it would result in his shock arrest.
Welcome back. Breaking news. In the past few minutes, Nissan has revealed that its chairman has been arrested.
Carlos Ghosn has been arrested for allegedly underreporting his income.
When he was arrested at Haneda Airport in Tokyo in November 2018, how much of a surprise was that?
It was a complete surprise to everyone. He himself used this rather unfortunate analogy of this being like Pearl Harbor.
You know, what happened in Pearl Harbor? Did you see Pearl Harbor happening? Did you notice what happened in Pearl Harbor?
In the sense that he had absolutely no idea that it was coming.
All of a sudden, a few prosecutors and a bunch of executives in Nissan said, you know what? This guy is a cold, greedy dictator. That's what I said. Cold, greedy dictator.
So yes, it came as a shock to the media, to the Japanese people, and of course, most of all, to Carlos Ghosn himself.
What did I do? Why am I being treated like a terrorist in Japan? Like somebody who's going to hurt other people? What did I do to deserve this treatment?
What was he charged with?
He faces four charges. Two relate to underreporting his salary, two a breach of trust, which is basically means that he's alleged to have used Nissan funds for private investments, one of which was a Silicon Valley company that was operated by his son. And there were also allegedly, again, payments he made in the form of consultancy fees to another member of his family. So there were four charges.
And presumably the argument they were making is that he's underreporting his income because he doesn't want people to realise that he's funding a lavish lifestyle.
Well, this is it. Yes, this all plays into this image of Carlos Ghosn that's been painted by his erstwhile colleagues, that he was cold and that he was greedy.
Okay, so the charges are essentially around financial misconduct, breach of trust, but he was placed in solitary confinement.
Yes, he was taken to Tokyo's main detention centre in the western outskirts of the city.
Without an understanding of what exactly I was being accused of, without access to the evidence that justify this travesty against my human rights and dignity.
I've been to one of those cells. I don't know if I saw Carlos Ghosn's particular cell, but I went on a visit to the same detention center last July, a few weeks after he got out on bail. And they are small. They're 7 square meters, so not very big at all.
130 days in prison, solitary confinement, tiny cell without window, light day and night, shower twice a week.
Ghosn said at his press conference on Wednesday that he was interrogated for up to 8 hours a day. The key thing here is that that happens without the presence of his lawyer. And I think this is one feature of the Japanese legal system that has surprised and dismayed so many people. The idea is that by having a suspect interrogated on his or her own, that it'll be easier for prosecutors to extract a confession. And that in turn feeds into this extraordinary figure that Japanese criminal cases that go to court, 99.9% of those cases end in a conviction.
So from that point of the arrest in November 2018, Ghosn spent 108 days behind bars. During that time, Nissan's board made the unanimous decision to dismiss him as chairman. Renault initially supported him, but he was forced to retire in January 2019. And then in March, the Japanese authorities surprised a lot of people by granting him bail. Tell me what happened.
Ghosn's defence lawyers had clearly managed to persuade the courts, and his bail was set at 1 billion yen, which is no small sum, but I don't suppose it was much of a problem for somebody with Carlos Ghosn's wealth. And then there was this slightly comical attempt to put reporters waiting outside the gates of the main Tokyo detention centre off the scent by having him dress up as a workman with a cap and a face mask. But of course, the most striking thing about Carlos Ghosn physically are his eyebrows, and his eyebrows were still visible. It fooled no one. And in fact, one of his lawyers who had come up with that ruse later apologised for what he admitted was a pretty stupid idea.
It's almost like a trial run of the disguise he'd go on to use to flee Japan. So he was put under house arrest. He didn't have an electronic tag. He was stopped from seeing his wife, Carol, who went on in the spring to travel to Lebanon. And there were vivid descriptions of their heartache. One of Ghosn's lawyers wrote a blog detailing this phone call where he signed off simply, "I love you, Habibi."
Yeah, I think it's this enforced separation from Carol Ghosn, which clearly affected Carlos Ghosn more than anything else.
And my husband's life has been destroyed. They have no reason because I have nothing to do with the case. Legally, I'm not involved. So we don't understand why they won't let us see each other.
He was also told towards the end of last year that there was very little prospect that he would be able to see Carol Ghosn over the Christmas and New Year that has just passed. And that may have played a part in what he decided to do next.
If you haven't heard, ousted Nissan Renault chief Carlos Ghosn has fled house arrest.
Carlos Ghosn has fled to Lebanon. The former CEO of Nissan has left Japan, where he faces charges of alleged financial wrongdoing.
On December the 29th, Ghosn walked out of the house in Tokyo where he'd been spending his bail and caught a bullet train to Osaka, hundreds of kilometres away in western Japan.
He had a hat on and one of those surgical masks that so many Japanese people wear at this time of year to stop themselves from catching a cold.
And then he prepared for the private flight that would get him out of the country.
Before, we think, he was placed in a large box that's usually intended for heavy audio equipment, taken through the immigration and security checks at Kansai International Airport in a section of the airport that's used for passengers on private jets. And then flown to Turkey and then on to Lebanon.
Justin, Ghosn is one of the most high-profile foreign celebrities in Japan. He's got a really distinctive face, as you've mentioned, with those big, bushy eyebrows and prominent sideburns. How did he possibly manage to get through unnoticed?
It appears that he took an incredible risk in not attempting to disguise himself. When he spoke to the media on Wednesday, he said that during his time out on bail, that he'd been out, he'd been to restaurants with family and friends.
I was walking everywhere in Tokyo alone. I had nobody guard. I went to restaurants, I went to movie, and people were greeting me. They were telling me, "Ganbatte kudasai," or something. They were saying, "We're sorry about happening to you."
Clearly, he wasn't going to be able to continue just wearing a face mask and a baseball cap going through customs and immigration at an international airport as somebody who is at the center of the, you know, the biggest white collar criminal case that Japan has seen for quite some time.
I'm not here to talk about how I managed to leave Japan, although I can understand that you are interested in that.
I don't think he is in any rush to flesh out the details of his exit from Japan.
Do we know if he had any help?
We know that he had help. I've heard reports that, you know, among the people who helped him were several who didn't know that they were helping Carlos Ghosn. And he did, in fact, hint, you know, well before he held his press conference, that he wasn't about to incriminate people who had helped him.
Carlos Ghosn claims he's willing to face justice.
I ain't run from justice. I want justice because justice is the only way I'm going to establish my reputation and the only way what I've done during my life is going to be recognised to its value.
But he says he doesn't feel he'd get a fair trial in Japan. How strong is the evidence against him?
As to whether Carlos Ghosn is guilty of the charges that have been levelled against him, we won't know until he does, in fact, face trial. And that looks incredibly unlikely, particularly given the fact that Lebanon doesn't have an extradition treaty with Japan. But he'd looked at Japanese legal precedent. He'd been charged. His court date hadn't been set, but he was definitely going to appear in court at some point.
Let us not forget that I was facing a system where the conviction rate is 99.4%. And I will bet you that this number is much higher for the foreigners.
And he was looking at a jail term of up to 15 years if he'd been found guilty of those charges.
It had been suggested to him that the four charges could end up taking 5 years to go through the Japanese courts. That would have meant he would be 70 years old by the time a ruling was brought down.
So I can tell you, that means it's not very difficult to come to conclusion. You're going to die in Japan or you're going to have to get out.
He believed, as he explained at his press conference, that if everything went as badly as it possibly could, and he had no reason to believe otherwise, that he would die in a Japanese prison.
And it also seems that supporters of Carlos Ghosn question Japanese motives. They suggest that the charges against him were somehow trumped up because essentially the country and Nissan itself was trying to avoid what you set out earlier, the idea of a full merger in which Nissan could essentially become a subsidiary of a French car maker.
And this is a theme that Carlos Ghosn has returned to several times while he was out on bail when he posted a video message.
The first message is I'm innocent. It's not new. You have heard it from me.
And named former colleagues of his at Nissan who believed were, in his words, backstabbing.
This is about a plot. This is about conspiracies. This is about backstabbing. That's what we're talking about.
Well, judging by his performance on Wednesday, supremely confident that he's done the right thing, that what he's done, in his own words, is not evade Japanese justice, but escape Japanese injustice.
I guess my final question then is, does his reputation survive?
His reputation, I think, would only have survived in perpetuity if he had found himself in a Japanese court and been acquitted. So I think you're probably going to see public opinion split. There are those who agree with everything he says about the Japanese criminal justice system, but then there'll be others who see him as a man who has fled justice and will forever remain a fugitive.
Justin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Justin McCurry. Do follow his reporting on this story at theguardian.com. Coming up, Gary Young, a giant of journalism. Now, Gary Young has long been my journalistic hero from the first time I heard him speak when I was at college, and he was breaking boundaries with his reporting here at The Guardian. He's been an inspiration, particularly to people of colour trying to get into this industry. So I'm pretty sad that he's leaving The Guardian as a staff writer and columnist after 26 years. In his final column, he said it was a dispiriting time for society, when the propensity to despair is strong. But then he gave this lovely piece of advice. Sing yourself up. Imagine a world in which you might thrive, for which there is no evidence, and then fight for it. Here's Gary Young.
When I was small, my mum used to put my feet on hers and dance around the living room to Baba Marcia's Young, Gifted and Black. And she'd say, they're playing our song. It was the early 70s and racism was on the rise. The economy was in the tank. People shouting us in the street. We lived in a mostly white neighbourhood. We had good friends too, but it was precarious. I was the youngest of three boys. She was raising us alone. She would have been under 30. And to me, what that meant, looking back on it, was we're going to have to imagine a world in which you thrive, because we can't see it. There's no evidence for it. But there's a world out there for you. I think we'd all like to think that we arrive where we arrive, that we achieve what we achieve through our own genius and hard work and all of that. But I don't think that's ever true. I think always people have paved the way for anybody to get where they are, even if it's the fact that you got where you are because your parents were who they are, that you never achieve anything entirely by yourself. And the route by which I came to The Guardian and got this space is very clear. In the 80s, when I was growing up, there were uprisings all over British towns and cities. Black people and Asian people rose up, had enough. And the Scott Trust, which owns The Guardian, decided that they'd had enough of having black people on the news pages but not in the newsrooms, and they set up a bursary scheme so that non-white people and other people who were underrepresented could study a postgraduate course in journalism. And by that stage, my mother was dead. I didn't have any parental support. I couldn't have afforded to have done that course. And I got on that course through the Scott Trust bursary. And after a little bit of freelancing, I ended up coming to The Guardian first as a translator, really, and then on the foreign desk and the home desk, and then features, and then finally I was given a column. And the year I was given a column was 1999. And that wasn't a coincidence either. That was the year of the McPherson report into Stephen Lawrence's death, which made institutional racism a mainstream talking point. That was also the year Yasmin Alibi Brown got her column in The Independent, and the year that Steve McQueen won the Turner Prize. The year before, Chris Ofili won the Turner Prize. The year after Zadie Smith's book, White Teeth, came out. There was something in the air. And that thing that was in the air wasn't a kind of sudden realisation, a sudden fit of benevolence on behalf of those who had jobs and prizes and money and books and columns. It was a realisation that something in Britain had to change. And there was a short window of time, and I was well positioned, really, to get through it. And so when people, racist people, I would say, demand that black people are grateful for what they have, I express my gratitude to the young working class black and Asian people who took to the streets and took on the system, and to the bereaved parents of children who died who took on the system, because inadvertently, without knowing my name, they paid for me and they made it possible for me to have the space that I've had. As I get ready to leave The Guardian after 26 years, I can feel politically, in terms of opportunity, the walls closing in for people who grew up in the way that I grew up, which was dark and poor and aspirant. And that makes me very sad. And I guess I leave this column and this institution with the lessons of my childhood, which is sometimes there's a world out there for you, for us, that we can't see, that there's no evidence for, but that we have to fight for, and that we have to imagine. And it's really when the imagination of that world dies that we're in trouble. As long as we can still imagine a better world and we fight for it, then there's hope.
That was Gary Young, who's becoming Professor of Sociology at Manchester University, although he'll still be writing, including articles for us. I wish him the best of luck, and I do encourage you to read his final column at theguardian.com. There's more information about the Guardian Scott Trust bursaries online. Applications are closed at the moment, but they open again in February. That's it for today. My thanks to Justin McCurry and to Gary Young. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.